In the mind of Putin, is he a madman or just a very strategic, sinister leader? Today, we're going to talk about the attack on Ukraine. Was it his plan all along to invade Ukraine? Was there anything that the world could have done to prevent this? Today on the show, we have Dr. Angela Stent, Senior Advisor to the Center for Eurasian, Russia, and Eastern European Studies for Georgetown University. We're going to dive into the mind of Putin. Will there be a winner in this fight? And we're also going to talk about her book, Putin's World: Russia Against the West and with the Rest. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios for the first time, the one and only Dr. Angela Stent. Hello, hello.
Delighted to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. You know, it's my show. We talk about so many different subjects, but we usually talk about wars of the past. But unfortunately, we're talking about a war that's currently going on, and we're just going to jump right into it. You know, your book, Putin's World, when you were writing this book, what were your thoughts on the possible invasion of the Ukraine?
So we knew that Putin held a lot of grievances about the collapse of the Soviet Union, which he called the world's greatest geopolitical catastrophe for the century, for the 20th century. And when I was writing the book, we knew already that Russia had annexed Crimea, that it invaded the southeastern part of Ukraine, the Donbas, and that there was an ongoing war there between Russian-backed separatists and Ukrainians. But I don't think I would have thought, or really anybody thought at this point, at that point when I was writing the book, and the first edition came out in 2019, nobody would have thought that there would be a full-scale invasion of Ukraine that we see now, with all the civilian casualties and the bombing, you know, the first major war in Europe, really, for 77 years.
Yeah, I totally agree. When I heard that he was putting his troops at the border, I thought, you know, this is just a scare tactic. You know, he's not going to go through with it. And then when they finally invaded, I was taken back. And I know even the president of Ukraine, you know, everybody was like, oh, no, they're not going to invade. And people that in the Ukraine was not even thinking about an invasion. It took them all by surprise. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think the president of Ukraine, he was given a lot of the information about those, right, you know, 150,000 Russian troops that were amassed around Ukraine. I think partly he said there isn't going to be an invasion because he didn't want the population
scared
to panic.
Yeah.
And also, it was already the threat of war was having a devastating economic effect in Ukraine. You know, people weren't investing. They were taking their money out. So I suspect that he may have had a better idea of what might happen, but he didn't want to cause a panic domestically.
Now, do you think that this was his plan all along, or was this something that is of recent?
I think probably he's been nurturing this probably at least for the two COVID years where he's been in isolation and apparently, you know, increasingly aggrieved by what's going on. When President Zelensky was first elected, I think President Putin thought that he was going to be able to deal with him because he came into office saying, I want to make peace with Russia.
Right.
And so I think Putin had different expectations of Zelensky, you know, inexperienced. He played a president on TV, you know, he's an actor the first time he was ever in
right
politics. And I think as time went on, and again, particularly, I think since Putin has been sequestered during COVID, apparently not seeing very many people. Even today, when you look at the pictures of him, anybody who wants to talk to him is sitting, I don't know, 30 or 40 feet away from him. I think then he got, increasingly angry about what was happening inside Ukraine, that President Zelensky was really encouraged by the West to tackle corruption, that he was clamping down on some Russian-connected oligarchs. He was closing some Russian-linked TV stations because he didn't like the sort of propaganda on them. So he wasn't compliant. And I think that probably fueled Putin's anger. And then I think as time went on, he looked at the West. President Trump wasn't able to deliver to President Putin what he promised he would, which would be, you know, a great new relationship.
Right.
President Biden comes into office, and then you have the, disorganized withdrawal from Afghanistan. You have an increasingly polarized United States. And he really thought that the U.S. was too divided and too distracted to sort of react. And he looked at Europe, too, and he saw the new German government was just forming, a French president who was, can you still see me?
I could still see you perfectly.
Oh, you can. So, sorry, something happened on my computer. Sorry about that.
Here That's I am. Okay.
a French president who was, distracted with the presidential election. So he thought this would be a good time to strike. But I think that he's been planning this, you know, for some time. In March of last year, the Russians first began to amass troops at the Ukrainian border. Then President Biden, called President Putin. He said, let's meet. They met. Things diffused. And then obviously they started the buildup again in October. So I think the other thing to say about this, I do not believe that President Putin has been getting good information about Ukraine. I think he really thought that it would be a cakewalk.
Right.
That they would go into Ukraine, the Ukrainians would surrender, they wouldn't want a war, and they have been totally taken aback by the resistance of the Ukrainians. They're fighting back. President Zelensky has emerged as a very strong war leader. So I think this invasion was partly based on a serious miscalculation about how easy it would be to accomplish subjugating Ukraine.
And I want to get back to that. But one thing you were talking about when President Trump was in office, Trump, he didn't want to really even be a part of NATO anymore. Don't you think that would have been kind of the perfect time to invade Ukraine and take over? Because it would have been a disruption in the NATO alliances.
So I think that's a great, what ifs of history.
Right.
Because as you say, President Trump was against NATO. He wanted to withdraw the United States from NATO. In the 2016 presidential campaign, he essentially said Ukraine belongs to Russia.
Right.
I wonder whether Putin didn't do it then because he was still hoping to get more from the relationship with Trump than he did get, that he was waiting to see whether Trump would deliver, a great economic relationship and leaving NATO. And had he invaded, it would have been much more difficult to accomplish that. But you're right, because from a logical point of view, the outside circumstances, the external circumstances would have been more favorable.
Oh, and that was my first thought. I was like, man, that would have been a perfect opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, NATO, Biden's in office. NATO is intact. I know one thing that Putin didn't want was Ukraine to be a part of NATO. But did you think Putin he knew that we wouldn't send troops to help Ukraine? Because, we're putting on very heavy sanctions. But what's your and first of all, do you think he knew that we wouldn't send in troops? And then, will even the sanctions help at all?
So I think, again, he underestimated NATO or the ability of the U.S. and Europe to come together. Again, don't forget about Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan was really, it was U.S.-led, but NATO was involved there. It looked as if NATO had kind of lost a purpose after this, bad ending to Afghanistan. And of course, during the Trump administration, relations between the US and Europe were bad. So I think he underestimated the extent to which the Biden administration has worked very hard, even before this crisis blew over, to improve ties with our European allies, to strengthen NATO. And then I think the other thing that Putin always seemed to underestimate is the impact that his actions have, producing exactly the opposite result. For instance, a few years ago, a majority of Ukrainians did not want to join NATO. With what Putin's done recently, now, I have an overwhelming majority of Ukrainians want to join NATO.
Right.
He's helped consolidate a Ukrainian national identity that didn't exist before. And he's now given NATO another purpose. a new purpose or an old purpose, which is to contain Russia.
Right.
And so he's produced the exact opposite of what he wanted. He thought that he could divide Europe and the US, and he hasn't been able to do that. And of course, we're sending all of these troops back. Again, you know, under Trump, the Trump administration said it was going to withdraw significant numbers of troops from Germany. That never happened. And of course, as you say, we're sending thousands of troops, we, the US and NATO, to the frontline NATO states that border Ukraine. Now, on the sanctions, you know, some people were arguing we should have had preemptive sanctions and that would have deterred Putin. I do not think that sanctions would have deterred Putin, and I don't think they're going to deter him now. I think the sanctions are much more than he ever envisaged. These are massive sanctions. And in the end, the export control sanctions, you're not going to feel that immediately, but it's going to make it much harder for Russia to just function as an industrial economy if it's deprived of all these components. But right now, the sanctions are obviously hitting many of Putin's cronies. They've hit the central bank and other Russian banks, cutting them off you know, from their ability to do business with the rest of the world. The ruble has sunk to a very new low, lower than it was during Russia's financial crash in 1998. So all of these things are impacting them now. But I think Putin has this kind of mentality, bunker mentality. He's holed up there. He's very angry about the sanctions. But what was his reaction? It was to declare that Russia's deterrent nuclear forces would be on special alert, whatever that means. In other words, to brandish nuclear weapons as his potential response to the sanctions.
And yeah, and when I saw that, and I was going to ask you, you know, I dare to say that the doomsday clock has gotten closer than it has in many years. That, you know, when I was a kid, we heard about the doomsday clock a lot. We don't hear about it as much these days, but definitely, it's definitely closer than what it was. And I mean, Putin's not a dumb man. I mean, he's not stupid. He definitely is very strategic, and I find it very difficult that he would actually get not good intel on what's going on, because you would think he would surround himself with the people that, especially with the KGB and all, you know, the, or at least, you know, I don't know if they even, do they still call it the KGB? I don't
it
even know.
It has a different name. I mean, yeah, being broken up into two different branches.
Right.
The FSB, which is the domestic intelligence, and the SVR, which is the foreign intelligence.
I mean, that shows you my age, because I remember the KGB. But it's hard that he would surround himself with people that are not up to par. Does that kind of show that his inflated ego is getting the best of him when it comes to thinking that he's all the powerful Oz?
I think, you know, I think it's possible that the people surrounding him do know the real situation better, but they don't want to tell him something that they know he doesn't want to hear. I mean, we had a clue last week. He summoned this meeting of his national security team, which was televised on public, you know, on their television. Again, he's sitting at one end of the room, they're sitting at the other. And each of the people had to stand up and say, we want you to recognize, you know, these two entities in Ukraine as independent countries. This is right. A couple of days before the invasion. And the chief of the foreign intelligence service stood there. And what he said wasn't, you know, enthusiastic enough for Putin. So in front of everyone else, Putin dresses him down, humiliates him, and makes him say, yes, Mr. President, you've got to recognize, you know, there's entities. Now, what that shows you is, you know, there's a power game going on here, that all of the people who advise him, and Mr. Naryshkin, the head of the Foreign Intelligence Services, is one of his key advisors, that they are, you know, constantly trying to sense out what it is that the boss wants to hear. So they may have a better sense of what's going on, but they don't want to tell him. And that's actually quite dangerous, obviously, because he really is living in a world where he doesn't have all the facts.
I mean, that, yeah, if you try to address something without the facts, it is very dangerous. Well, is there a true winner in this invasion? You know, even though, if, you know, the Ukrainian people rise up and they, you know, hold back the military, where do we go from here? Where does it stop?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to see where there's a true winner. So what you have now is, you know, you've got continuing resistance on the part of Ukrainians.
Right.
You've got more indiscriminate bombing, particularly over the second largest city, which is near the border with Russia, Kharkiv. You've got all these civilian casualties. You know, Putin said, we're not going to touch civilians. Well, of course, there's civilian casualties. So you've got all the bombing going on. It reminds me a little bit of when Putin first came to power, he made his name really by launching a second war against Chechnya.
Mm-hmm.
And they used these kind of carpet bombing tactics. They razed the capital city, Grozny, to the ground, indiscriminate bombing. So there's some of that going on. And then you have this column of tanks that's trying to encircle Kiev and take the capital. But of course, as we know, the Ukrainians are resisting. So this could go on for a very long time. They might try and starve, you know, Kiev out, a little bit like what happened to Putin's parents during World War II, during the siege of Leningrad. So that's, it's a very bad picture all around. I think the thing that worries people is, let's say the Russians do in the end capture or subdue Kiev in the beginning, and they put in power a puppet government, a pro-Russian government that will do what Russia wants. It's hard to see that that government can stay in power Russian troops leave. So they're going to have troops occupying there for who knows how long. And then the question is, where does this end? I mean, there'll be a resistance. The Ukrainians will resist. I think the West will help them. But then you have to think about the unexpected and unintended consequences of any war. You know, Ukraine has neighbors, Poland, Romania, and the Baltic republics who are in NATO. What happens if somehow one of those countries were affected by this, were directly affected by it? What would NATO do? The reason there aren't U.S. troops there is because the United States realizes it cannot get into a direct conflict with Russia, a nuclear superpower. So there's a lot that we don't know there. From Putin's point of view, I think he wants to then, in his ideal mind, he would form a new state consisting of Belarus, which is already very dependent on Russia, and then this new Ukrainian entity, and they'd be like a Slavic Union. And then maybe he would set his sights further west. In December, one of the treaties that was presented to the US and NATO said that NATO had to withdraw to where it was in 1997 before it first enlarged. So Putin's sights may be not only a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space, but in fact, in the former Warsaw Pact countries in Central and Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's where it gets scary, because NATO and America, UK, you know, where there has to be a line driven to where we try to step in and stop the expansion of Russian troops and Putin, and also even just letting Ukrainians starve. What do you think would happen if, you know, the U.S. or somebody tries to get in food to them or ammunition? I mean, we're trying to do that now. We can now, but will he take it to a different level? Because I've even heard on the news this morning, I believe that, or the, was it the ambassador to the UN saying that he's using weapons that are not supposed to be used. So what, you know, will we step in and then will he use a nuclear bomb?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, they're using cluster munitions, which are, you know, which shouldn't be used. I mean, we, the West, are still, I think we're still able to get in things like a Stinger missiles and javelins and some other military equipment. But even that is very challenging because, you know, it has to come over land because the airspace is basically interdicted. I mean, you can't deliver things by air. So if there were a situation where they were trying to starve the people in Kiev out, I'm sure that there would be attempts to creatively get things to the Ukrainians, but it could become increasingly difficult. And again, always realizing that NATO was going to be very careful to make sure that there aren't direct confrontations between people from NATO countries and Russian troops.
Also, I mean, I'm sure you've heard that, you know, Finland is now looking to maybe join NATO. And of course, you know, neighbors to Russia. And they the president of Finland's been kind of a middleman between a lot of discussions. How do they have enough troops? I mean, I think I read where Russia has maybe a million troops that are active. And I'm sure they have many reserves. And then I'm going to ask a question after that. But how do they have enough troops to continue that fight with Ukraine and now maybe picking a fight with Finland? And, I mean, I just don't see how the Russian people would even want to continue that.
So, first of all, the Russians have increasingly been using these mercenary groups. The most famous one is Wagner, whose owner also was the owner of this internet, you know, troll factory
right.
that attacked the U.S. in 2016. So they use mercenary troops and they have plausible deniability and they say, well, they're not official Russian troops. So they have more than, you know, the official army. But I agree with you that, you know, first of all, if they have to occupy Ukraine, they don't really have enough troops to do that in the long run.
Right.
Nor do they have enough troops to, if they get in conflicts with other neighboring countries. So they, and you can already see the military hasn't performed as well.
Right, exactly.
As they thought it would. So, it would be a dilemma for them and it would not be a good idea for them to pick fights with other countries.
I found that very fascinating that Putin, again, he comes across as such a strong presence and a very egotistical leader. And with his background with the KGB, to allow his troops, his army to become weak looking. And then with the economy, it was hurting before the sanctions, or because we had sanctions with him. But now with the extreme sanctions, how he's going to be able to keep that army going, you know, keeping them paid and, you know, keeping them fed and they have a lot of gas, so they definitely have the fuel to provide them. But how, I just find it fascinating that he would allow his army to become weak at all.
Yeah. Well, and again, he may not fully understand that that's the situation. We come back to this question of how much information does he really have?
Right.
You know, the Russians really did build up their military after the Russia-Georgia war in 2008, which they obviously won, but where the military performed quite badly.
Right.
And so it's in better shape than it was before. But of course, there are limited resources. And that then, you know, gets to the question, if this drags on for a long time and Russians suffer more. I mean, the other thing is, you know, we haven't had a situation since 2014, when there was the outbreak of the hostilities in the Donbas region,
right.
when you've had significant numbers of body bags coming back. The Russian people were not prepared for this invasion, if you watch state media. And I'm sure that once the body bags start coming back, there will be more protests, even though Russia is by now a very repressive state. There will be unrest because of that. And then we get to the question, at some point, are there consequences for Putin if things continue to go badly?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know the answer to that. He looks as if he's pretty much firmly in power and he's quashed all opposition. Opposition people are in jail or they've left the country. But in the longer run, I think that would raise issues about what happens to him.
Yeah, and that's, I was going to bring that up next is, you know, even with today's technology, you know, people, internets and Facebooks and all that. I know, you know, Putin does have his thumb on a lot of the media. And but, you know, now that many of American companies, tech companies, Apple are pulling out of TikTok or completely pulling out of Russia, the people of Russia are not going to be able to get the information, the true information that they need to hear. And, you know, we're seeing protest in the streets, you know, I'm sure probably even more than what we're seeing. But like you said, they're getting arrested and put in jail or who knows what's happening to them. Like you said, I heard 6,000 people or soldiers this morning from Russia were reportedly killed. You know, when the mamas start receiving their sons and daughters home, that's when things start to change. Do you agree with that?
I do. And again, we come back to, I think, Putin's initial mistake in believing that this was going to be over in 2 days.
Right.
Interestingly enough, RIA Novosti, which is one of the government-run news outlets, published an article on its website 2 days after the invasion began, an article that was probably written even before the invasion, talking about how easy it had been to win and that the Ukrainians welcomed with them with open arms and we're in a new world today and, you know, America is finished, et cetera, et cetera. Now, they have taken that article down, but it was up there long enough for some of us to read it and say, wow, this is what they thought was going to happen 2 days after the invasion. You know, Ukraine would have surrendered. And so because of that miscalculation, you know, now you are going to have and will have all these body bags coming back. And I, you know, that they haven't, I think, reckoned that they would have to deal with this kind of situation going forward.
Well, in your book, Putin's World, what was the idea of wanting the West to know about who Putin was or is, and why is he wanting to regain the USSR or Soviet Union to what it was? I mean, he's had 22 years in office, that he has control of the military and pretty much media and everything else. How is he having trouble building that back up to where it was?
So, I mean, I originally wanted to write the book because, you know, I was very aware after 2014, after the annexation of Crimea, that, mm-hmm. you know, the West, you know, was viewing Putin increasingly with alarm and concern and realizing, right. You know, that exactly what his intentions were. But much of the rest of the world, China, obviously, India,
right.
And then, you know, countries in Latin America, in Africa, in the Middle East, you know, viewed Russia as a large authoritarian country with whom they could do business. And it's interesting to see even now playing out, China has not, you know, hasn't criticized Russia. It's abstained in the United Nations Security Council, mm-hmm. Voting against it. India abstained as well. A number of other countries, you know, are not going to join sanctions. So it was really to explain, you know, how this in a way gives this particular Russian government a lifeline, because the West is the antagonist, but not necessarily the rest of the world. Now, you know, Putin, I think, has had these desires. I think you have to go back to Putin's time between 1985 and 1990, when he was a mid-level KGB agent, a case officer in East Germany. And when the war came down and Germany was unified, essentially that part of his KGB career, and he was a young man then in his 30s, was over. And so he experienced, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism really as a personal disaster for him, because, you know, he thought that he was, you know, going to rise to great heights in the KGB. And so he's been convinced since he became leader that his role was to restore Russia as a great power, and to relitigate, if you like, the end of the Cold War, to push back against the kind of post-Cold War settlement, and recreate one that was much more to Russia's advantage. Now, it's taken him that long to do it because, you know, he's had to build up the economy, to build up the military.
Right.
And that Russia is now in a position where it does have a much stronger military, and its economy was doing reasonably well. And even today, you know, with all the sanctions, as long as oil prices are this high, and they're high because of the war, he's still making a lot of money out of selling oil.
Oh yeah.
So he's waited this long, probably, to get enough, to make sure that Russia is strong enough to do this. But it may also be, as he has gotten older, he's turning 70 this year, he's maybe thinking about his legacy, and he appears to be more removed from reality now, again, since this COVID period, and maybe those things have come together to make him realize this is the time where he has to rebuild, if you like, the Russian Empire, to gather in the lands that Russia lost after the Soviet collapse.
I probably, because we're recording this, that I hate to even compare, but it's almost like a famous comedian that we know here in America. I'm not even going to say the name, but it's like, you know, going and becoming this major star and a television star, a famous comedian, and then you get into your 70s and the 80s, and then all of a sudden find out that, you know, you had drug women to, you know, be with them sexually. And it's like you ruined your legacy. And it's almost like, why would you wait until the end of, you know, because 70, you're still young, but it's, you're at the end of your career as a leader. Why would he risk that to invade a country? I mean, I guess, you know, when you start trying to think of to get into somebody's mind, you're like, how would somebody do that? Why do you think the invasion was so important to him for his legacy?
I think that he has had this obsession with Ukraine. I mean, last July, he came out with this 5,000-word essay saying that Ukrainians and Russians were one country, they were one people that had been artificially, he blamed Lenin for creating the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic within the Soviet Union. He blamed everyone else. And that Ukraine belonged to Russia, and that the danger was that Ukraine could be used by the West as a launching pad, you know, for an invasion of Russia.
Right.
Now, you can look at this from the outside and say, look, this isn't the 20th century. Russia was invaded twice by Germany in the 20th century. It lost 27 million people in World War II. But this is Russia today.
Yeah.
It's a nuclear superpower, an energy superpower, a geographic superpower. No one's going to invade Russia. Right. Least of all, by the way, the United States, but certainly not Ukraine, which is much weaker. And yet he seems to feel, and he keeps going back to history, his version of history, that Russia is somehow vulnerable and that he has to strike out before somebody strikes him. And I apparently that's something that's motivating him to do what he's doing now. I think before he launched the war, he knew there would be sanctions, but he sort of discounted them. I don't think he knew they would be quite as vast as they are now. But I think that's one of the reasons why he is doing it now. He genuinely seems to believe it's his historic mission to reunite Ukraine and Russia and to push back the West.
All right, just a couple more questions, and I'll let you go because I know you're a very busy lady at this day and age because a lot of people are wanting information. Let's go back to the early 1990s. Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. America and the NATO allies come together. They fight back. They go into Baghdad. The heroes save the day. But eventually they got rid of Saddam Hussein. With this invasion, it's hard to believe that NATO and the powers of the world will let this go unpunished. And it's hard to just say a slap on the hand, I'm going to take a few dollars out of your pocket. I mean, do you think his time as leader of the Russian people is coming to a close?
Well, if this war continues to be such a challenge for them, and if things get worse in Ukraine and, you know, worse things happen to the Ukrainian population, I wonder how long he can last as the head of that system. I mean, it's not good for Russia, and there are more and more Russians who are opposing this. The European Union, for instance, is thinking about making it easy for both Ukrainians and Russians now to get asylum there. So it's very hard to see how this drags on and gets worse without something happening to him.
Yeah.
But we don't have any, you know, there's no obvious person waiting in the wings to take over.
And that was my last question, is what does happen after Putin is gone? Where does Russia go from there if there's nobody waiting in the wings? And he's definitely not ready to step down.
Right. He's not ready to step down. And I don't know whether he'll ever be able to or willing to have a managed transition as, Yeltsin did when he retired from office. So he could stay in power, you know, for quite a long time. I mean, as long as he isn't removed by a street revolution, which he probably won't be, one would assume that whoever comes to power after him would still, you know, be part of the system. They might not share all his views, and they might be more cognizant of the fact that Russia should, you know, be focusing on its own modernization as a state and not so focused on antagonistic relations with the West. It would take some time to sort of disentangle Russia from the foreign policy that it now has, but it could over time. And I think that's what one has to hope, that whoever succeeds him, you know, even if, you know, they certainly don't want to become a Western democracy, would at least understand that it's better to not have such adversarial relations with large parts of the world.
And I think we've all learned that, you know, between with every president and every leader, you hope that once a leader is gone, it's replaced with somebody that can do better for the country and for the world. But sometimes we don't get what we want.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see. But I hope everybody goes out and picks up Dr. Angela Stint's book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West, and with the rest. Where can people find your book? And tell us, do you have any events coming up to where people might be able to hear you speak?
Well, the book, the easiest thing is to order it from Amazon. You know, the publisher is 12 books, but I believe it's cheaper to order it from Amazon. It's certainly there. And I mean, this morning we just had a public event with the Brookings Institution. We're going to be having these, I think, regularly. So if you go on their website, you can see when there are events at which I'm speaking. And I know that in a couple of weeks, there'll be a couple of events that I'm speaking at the week after next at Georgetown University, one on Monday the 14th and one on Friday the 18th. Again, if you go on the Georgetown School of Foreign Service website, you can find those events there.
Well, Dr. Angela Stint, thank you so much for being on Truth Be Told. You were amazing, and thank you, and hopefully you'll come back and see us again.
Great. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, and everybody, thank you for joining Truth Be Told. We hope you enjoyed it, and please support Dr. Angela Stint. Go to her social medias, purchase the book, and definitely I can't wait to hopefully see her live at some speaking engagement. I know she's going to be great. But until next time, I'm Tony Sweet for Truth Be Told. We hope you have a great day, and let's say some prayers for the Ukrainian people. Take care. This has been another episode of Truth Be Told. Thank you so much for watching. Recorded live at UBN Go Studios in Burbank, California. Join us on social media. Facebook, Truth Be Told Radio. Instagram, Truth Be Told Paranormal. Go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for more information on upcoming shows.